Late Night Live, ideas and opinions from around the world.
Welcome, beloved listeners, gladdies and poddies and noddies, to another Late Night Live. A little later in the program, I'm taking you to a place called Batmania. Would you believe that was to be the name of Melbourne? And we're going to discuss the origins of Batmania in some detail, much of which I think you'll find quite astonishing. But first, you may recall that I offered our long-term collaborator, Bruce Shapiro, political asylum in this country from the political asylum that is his country. And he has arrived in the studio seeking it. And he's brought with him a toothbrush and a little very crowded valise. Welcome to the safety, the comparative safety and sanity of Australia.
You know, I was all set to claim my papers, and then there's this carbon tax. It's hopeless. It's hopeless. It's all over.
You're leaving me already. Look, I'm not joking. At the moment, your country, which is always problematic and turbulent, is teetering on the edge of total political madness.
Or at least total financial madness. I
mean, one leads to the other, doesn't it?
Well, and there's madness going in several directions at the moment. It is a singularly weird time. The first, of course, is this economic brinksmanship, where we have Obama and the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, in a kind of hockey face-off, just waiting for that moment when the deficit ceiling expires. And it looked as if, here's where it gets weird, that's an ordinary moment in politics, it looked as if they had actually struck something of a compromise. The president had agreed to consider some changes in the structure of Social Security and other government entitlements.
Even sacrosanct Medicare.
Sacrosanct Medicare, well, and even more sacrosanct Social Security, which has been, of course, in the U.S., is something that goes back to Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the Great Depression. Didn't put Social Security on the table, but even changes in the structure of it. Boehner, on the other hand, had agreed to some tax increases. And, you know,
I didn't realize he had.
Symbolic
tax increase.
He'd been prepared to consider to put on the table some tax increase. But he faced what here would be a backbench rebellion. It was a Tea Party rebellion from the faction of the Republican Party, which is at this point hardcore libertarian and is essentially saying, we don't care what else you do. We don't care how big the deficit is. We don't care what it means to our cities, our communities, to our states, to the ability of the country to do it. The one thing we will not go for is raising taxes. And so now what looked like a deal is off. And
of course, this fellow has a very strange skin tone. He always looks puce, as though he's slightly irradiated, but he must be red in the face by now.
Oh, he's purple, if not red. I mean, he does have a strange skin tone, and he's also given to saying strange things at strange times, which may be attributed to character, may be attributed to legal substances. But right now, he's embarrassed and livid. Obama has gotten on television and essentially said, as he has said a few other times before, and each time successfully, we need to be grown-ups. I mean, he's literally gone on TV and said, we need to eat our peas. That's been the way he has put this.
Would you translate that? That is not a term that is completely familiar in the Australian vernacular, where peas
eat those vegetables that you would say to a child. Eat those unpleasant vegetables.
Right, gotcha.
It's time to kind of grow up and take your medicine. And now I will say that the left wing of the Democratic Party was not happy with Obama on the compromises he was prepared to make. But those compromises now are off, and we are at a pure Mexican standoff, where the stakes in a few weeks' time are the U.S.'s ability to refinance its debt and the what is being portrayed as the possibility of a default that will send financial markets reeling. The grown-ups in the Republican Party clearly see this, I think, as bad for them. Obama has pointed out that people who are refusing to compromise now, who are talking about a short-term extension, really don't want to be renegotiating this in September or October when they're actually running for re-election. It's hard to see where the Republicans go. They have painted themselves into a corner, but it is
Bruce,
crazy.
Across the ocean, The Economist, not a rabidly left-wing journal, it finds the whole thing quite perplexing and points out that America's net indebtedness is, and I quote, a perfectly affordable 65% of GDP. In other words, it's not quite as apocalyptic as we are led to believe.
It's not, but what we have is a generation in which thus an entire generation of the Reagan-era nostrum that debt is bad and a balanced budget is good. Also, the issue is not so much the level of debt as the government's ability to refinance that debt with its current revenue streams.
But the people are still buying bonds in America.
Absolutely, people are still buying bonds. Our international creditors are still buying bonds. But will we be able to continue servicing them? I think we will. And, you know, this it does remind me of a similar brinksmanship that was played during the Clinton era around Social Security and Medicare. We had a very similar argument at that time. It wasn't about the debt per se. It was about these entitlement programs. Social Security is
but
going to go
on
back.
That occasion,
never
the
did.
Republicans blinked.
The Republicans blinked. Bill Clinton took it in the single very successful fight he waged during his presidency was to take that one up to the moment of default with Newt Gingrich. The Republicans blinked. Bill Clinton began his affair with Monica Lewinsky, which is a different matter. But it was a moment where the president challenged the ideologues within the Republican Party and won.
Yeah, but of course he can't challenge them now successfully in the Republican Party. Even the classic Republicans can't challenge
well, that's,
them.
Well, see, the Republicans are split. And going into a presidential election year, but also a congressional election year. We've been talking for weeks about how well the libertarianism of the Tea Party folks plays going into the primaries. It plays much less well going into next fall's elections.
We've been, like every other media outlet, we've been looking at what's going on with Rupert in London.
Indeed.
I always thought that what Rupert's been up to in the US eclipses by orders of magnitude what's going on in London. But I have to ask you this. What line is Fox taking, Fox News, given that they're such adroit stirrers on this issue of negotiation between the Republicans and the White House?
Oh, well Fox is playing into the polarization in a big way. I mean, Fox has never especially liked John Boehner. They are playing to the Tea Party line and really trying to stir up the anti-government, anti-spending base. The entire idea here has nothing to do with shrinking government, because, of course, under Reagan and Bush, the government grew by leaps and bounds. The deficit grew by leaps and bounds. It does have to do with freeing up capital for private investment. I mean, that's where the Republicans are hoping the center of gravity will shift. Obama is trying to pull it away from that and into, as he has been all along, into investments sort of in the social contract. And that's the basic debate. He's also trying to remain the coolest-headed guy in the room as all those about him lose their tempers. That's the public style that he's adopted for this.
He was looking a little stronger, in fact, significantly stronger in the polls after a few successes, in fact, almost verging on triumphs. How's he playing at the moment? Is he being, in effect, blamed for the mess?
Right now, or as of the last set of polls, his numbers remained up. The next few weeks are going to be very critical. Are people going to see him as a leader? Are Democrats going to continue to see him as a leader or a compromiser among Democrats? That's a huge argument now.
Democrats are stuck with him, of course.
Democrats are stuck with him, but you can hear growing panic on the left of the party. There's a growing call, for example, to invoke the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which allows, in its language, seems to allow the president to negate any congressional challenge to the country's debt. There's a presidential authority around debt that's in the Constitution. And a lot of people, like my friends at The Nation magazine on their editorial page, have been challenging the president to exert his authority, stop playing games with the Republicans, and instead just say, we can solve it.
Let me ask you in parenthesis, this little thing in the Constitution, are we talking about the original document or an amendment to the Constitution?
Well, we're talking about an amendment to the Constitution, but contained in the Bill of Rights. So in the original group of amendments that was passed in 1789,
a venerable amendment.
A venerable amendment.
Right.
And it's never really been pushed. Essentially, it says that Congress cannot take any action that challenges the ability of the country to undertake or maintain debt. And it's an area of presidential authority that has never been tested. Now is a testing time. It would go against Obama's style. We've seen again and again and again that his style is to let Congress, both Democrats and Republicans, be the outliers on issues, to fail, and then for him to step in. And that may work this time again. It certainly worked with healthcare. That was the style, and we've seen it on other issues as well. He seems to love throwing balls out to Congress, watching them go like piranhas in a tank, and then stepping in calmly and saying, okay, Congress has now proven it can't handle it. I'm in charge here.
Let's take the focus off federal politics and go back to the beleaguered and financially traumatized states. We've chatted in the recent past about the need to open the prisons, let people out of the slab in large numbers because it's unaffordable to keep them. But it's now affecting higher education quite dramatically.
Oh, quite dramatically. For example, I live in the state of Connecticut, a modest but historically pretty affluent state. The University of Connecticut is losing millions of dollars in state aid. Universities, state universities, are largely paid for by the individual states by tax revenues and endowments. The budget crisis in Connecticut, as one example, is affecting cities in deep ways. The city where I live, New Haven, Connecticut, gets millions of dollars a year, $8-10 million a year in state aid that they're about to lose. And for a small city, suddenly having an $8 million budget gap is almost unimaginable. Do they lay off teachers in secondary schools? Do you engage in, we're beginning to engage in some crazy things like asking people or giving parking tickets on Saturdays and Sundays in a desperate effort to raise short-term revenue. We already have some of the highest property taxes in the country, so the mayor is reluctant to raise taxes on homeowners even more for fear of driving them out.
Particularly when the value of their homes is going down.
Yeah. I mean, essentially what this economy has done, and it is trickle-down, it's a race to the bottom rather than trickle-down prosperity. What's happened is that by a generation of economic policies, but in particular the last couple of years, that have protected private wealth, the state of Connecticut now finds itself in a crisis where it's unable to fulfill its social obligations. We've got a political crisis in my own state, Connecticut, as a result of this. We have a Democratic governor, much beloved by labor unions, elected with their support, who who negotiated with trade union leaders what he thought was a package of givebacks on wages and pensions and so on. This was rejected by the rank and file of the public trade unions, public sector trade unions. And so the government itself in Connecticut is now facing the possibility of coming to a grinding halt. It's a huge political crisis.
The psychological impact on Americans must be a bit like what we observed when the Soviet Union collapsed, and suddenly people who'd been, whatever objections, whatever problems they might have had with Moscow, they were a superpower. Suddenly overnight, they saw their country fall apart and they felt themselves falling into poverty. Here's mighty America with its manifest destiny, with its, the greatest nation in the history of the world, under the personal supervision of God, looking down the toilet. What's happening to the psyche of Americans?
Well, we've been living for the last decade in a state of profound denial and avoidance about foreign policy, about the war, right? And I think we may have gotten accustomed to that. I mean,
what to denial?
Well, so there's somebody I was talking to recently described our situation in Afghanistan and Iraq as a friends and family war. If you have friends and family in the service, you relate to it, and otherwise it's off the radar. Right now, this is a friends and family economic crisis. If your home is in foreclosure, if you are a middle-class person who has lost her or his job, then you're in trouble. On the other hand, consumer spending is up, and people are using credit cards more than they were a year ago. And, actually, the Obama administration is feeling kind of good about that piece of the economy. So I think it hasn't hit home yet that we are facing really a wholesale crisis in our ability to deliver things like education, healthcare, basic social, middle class social welfare, not just, the safety net for the poor, but things that people count on for their aging parents or for themselves, for their kids. This really is fundamentally at risk, and in a way that goes all the way from the federal government and its ability to spend on crucial programs, down to the states, down to the municipalities.
At times like this, when economies are under stress, when there are fracture lines opening up, people look for someone to blame. For Nazi Germany, it was easy. It was the Jews. There's often been a nice, easy focus. I would have thought that Wall Street could have filled that function for a while, but that seems to have passed over.
It may yet. I think it's.
I mean, who are people blaming?
Well, here again, you have polarization. I mean, I think the Tea Party has whatever base it has because of exactly those resentment politics. And those folks, and Fox and many of the personalities on Fox TV, for example, are blaming Obama and the Democratic Party as if they were Vladimir Lenin, right?
And as if they'd been in power for the last 15 years.
Yeah. You also are seeing in many parts of the country, especially the border regions, blaming of immigrants. We do have a rise of anti-immigrant sentiment. In the last year, Arizona has passed its anti-immigrant bill that we've talked about, all this. So there's that kind of blame going on. On the other hand, in the recent demonstrations in Wisconsin and other states, you've seen the kind of labor and activist side of the Democratic Party blaming the Republicans. So I think we don't have one national enemy at this moment, and that's probably a good thing.
And people have stopped blaming Bush. He's now ancient history.
He's just off the radar.
I mean, and the big swinging dicks and the masters of the universe who played such a central role in the global financial crisis are also fading from view.
Well, they are, although some of them are, in the Obama administration. And
true.
That, the Wall Street, the Wall Street and finance industry people are still managing to have to save their own bacon pretty well. There was a study recently of of CEO salaries that at a time of potentially huge economic crisis was pretty distressing. Very, very high salaries remaining for CEOs, especially, but not only in finance industry. So, I think we will enter a period of accelerating and exceptional anger if this budget crisis isn't resolved.
There is a chance, which Obama must be trying to calculate in the long game that he likes to play, that the resentment will swing back wholeheartedly on the Tea Party, on the Republicans themselves.
That's the game right now. You know, that's behind this, the patronizing language that he uses, which is a risk, because he can come across as a little bit aristocratic. It kind of reminds me of 1968, when Mayor Richard Daley I of Chicago was overseeing the Democratic National Convention. Police are beating up protesters outside, and Senator Abraham Ribicoff of Connecticut, actually, a patrician, a very kind, smart, thoughtful patrician politician, got up to nominate George McGovern for the presidency, denounced what he called Nazi tactics in the streets of Chicago, and as Mayor Daley gave a one-finger salute from the floor of the Democratic Convention, he kind of looked down his nose and said, "How hard it is to accept the truth." And on the one hand, that's very exciting for those of us who thought these were Nazi tactics in the streets of Chicago. But I'm not sure that it was a politically winning tone to adopt. The question is Obama going to be successful in portraying the Republicans as children who are playing games? It's an echo of his inauguration speech when he said, quite eloquently, quoting the Bible, "There comes a time to put away childish things." He's trying to echo that moment now. Or is he going to look like a finger-wagging elitist who's going to make it easy for the populists in the Tea Party to parody him?
Yeah. It's lovely to have you in the studio. The last time we were together was, of course, in Gotham City.
Indeed.
And New York City. Which I think really should be called Batmania, shouldn't it?
It can be pretty batty. Right now, the major argument in New York City is over bicycle lanes. Poor Mayor Bloomberg has been doing his best for the last couple of years to put in better bicycle lanes and rent-a-bikes and things in New York City. And a lot of the merchants are very angry because they're having to give up 2 inches of sidewalk for these things. And that in New York City is a violation of the state religion. So there's actually a very emotional fight going on between auto commuters, bicyclists, and street-side merchants.
Live and kicking in the studio, the real as opposed to the merely electronically suggested Bruce Shapiro. Lovely to see you, Bruce.
As always.
And we're going to play a little bit of music and then go to Batmania, the real one down here in the Southern Hemisphere. Late Night Live, ABC Radio National and all those other tricky things.